Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Talk with Tenny. If you'd like to call in, the phone number is area code 267-521-0167. Area code 267-521-0167. It's been an interesting day for me. I went over to Left Forum for a little while today and presented with Seth Farber and a couple other people. And our presentation really struck a nerve with a couple of the psychiatrists in the room, which I guess is the sign of a good day. The presentation panel discussion was called Anti-Psychiatry's Challenge to the Left, Saz, Lang, and the Mad Movement. And so we had some really interesting conversation around the different waves of the anti-psychiatry movement and how psychiatry themselves, or the left specifically, might be able to assist in breaking down some of the constant badgering of the media that we're experiencing because of the psychiatric profiling. There were some really thoughtful people in the room also, and I think that that's also really great. And I think there were definitely some good conversations that came out of it, and hopefully that will continue to come out of it in the future. But you really can raise the heckles of a psychiatrist when you suggest the truth of there being no biological evidence for any psychiatric disorder, no brain scan, blood test, genetics, etc. They were not happy that this message was being put out, and so I think that we need to continue to speak up and that we need to tell our stories about how what we experienced through psychiatry, and to let others know that there are ways in which people can get out of the system and really heal their lives without needing to rely on psychiatric drugs or institutions or the message that somebody is sick, and instead really look at all of the ways that we can flourish and grow and thrive and contribute. I have a caller on the line. Are you there? Hello?
Hello, how are you doing, Lauren?
Hey, Yvonne, how are you?
I'm sorry I missed you yesterday. I was exhausted. In fact, I didn't wake up, but I noticed that our Nemesis of Evil, Tori, is going to be on NPR Radio, and I was just looking up to see when he's going to be on so that people can listen in and also let NPR know how they feel about him being on once he's been heard. I was very disappointed because one of my peers had said something about this being NPR being legitimate radio, and I think that the Lauren Tenney Show is legitimate radio. And
well,
we're not, our message is not getting across on the mainline media, and so that's why I understand that you and others started the K-Line, and I'm so happy that you have done so. But it's going to be June the 2nd at 10:06 a.m.
June 2nd at 10:06 a.m., huh?
The debate over the forced treatment of the severely mentally ill. And I am just suggesting, and I don't know how you feel about it, Lauren, is that whenever the people who want us to have forced treatment get a forum, we should not be silent. that we should, during or after whatever presentation they have, whether it's in newsprint, whether it's in radio or television, that we should make our voices be heard. I mean, it makes me feel good when we speak on your talk line about it. But also, we've got to let the press, who people that other than ourselves listen to know that this is not a good thing.
Absolutely.
And I hope that other people will, when they call in, will let our wider community know about these other instances where they're propagating this falsehood. Because I caught the tail end of what you're saying, but it's like, you know, people don't know. I was a true believer, too, at one time. I never got a good night's sleep until I was 40 years of age. But I also gained 100 pounds and threatened and had arthritis and other things. And as a result of moving off of medications, and our minds was not a case of force, I've gotten healthier. And I just feel very strongly that other people shouldn't have to go through this where they're tortured, whether it's through, and most people don't get ECT, but through the chemicals that are out there that don't really help them get better.
Absolutely, and I think that this is part of the problem. And I agree with you 100,000%. We need to be reaching the mainstream media. We need to be responding every time they put up a call like this, and we have to really reach out to people and encourage them to speak out and to continue to speak out. For every time somebody gets even a letter to the editor published, it's another way of reaching thousands, tens of thousands of people potentially with our message. And so I think that everybody should be speaking out
and
to the mainstream.
Saying that they have that call, they don't. Essay I had written with 1,200 words. I'm not that good of a writer as far as the structure. And other people said, well, you have good ideas, but you don't write well. You don't speak well. So I sent it out to 2 or 3 people to see if they could help me. I said, have I left anything out? I got someone else who could help me with the grammar and stuff. But you know something? These very same people are shying away, and they're saying that they look at the Wall Street Journal and NPR is doing legitimate news media. And what I say is that we need our own media because our words aren't getting out. And people that know these things are not speaking up. They are so concerned about their contracts they have, grants they have, so they're being quiet, I guess, figuring that if they be quiet, they'll keep their income stream, not realizing, not looking at the details of what's happening with the Murphy bill and what's happening around the country, that they're not going to be providing services for our peers because all of that cash is going to go to inpatient. And I just feel really kind of sad that people are that way. I talked to someone who was in leadership in our local advocacy, and they were acting as if they've done everything that they could do. And it hurt my heart to the core. I said, you don't understand. I said, we're in a pivotal situation here wherein if things go the way that people want it to go, we will have more people locked up. And I know the reason why this is happening. Some people don't realize this, but the current presidential administration and the Justice Department issued a call that people who have been not convicted of violent crimes, but there has been an injustice because maybe they were charged with, let's say, using drugs, and they got unusual sentences. For example, those people who used crack cocaine versus cocaine got very high sentences. And there's a watershed amount of those people that are going to come out who don't have violent crimes, you know, users of the speak. And there are some people that just feel like these people should not be in there. They do not feel that other people who may have some emotional difficulties, that they should not be walking around unchemically lobotomized and not have choice in what they're going to do. And this is a danger to everyone. Anyone who's out here, even a person who was, I recently saw where Donald, what's his name, the guy who was head of the Clippers, they ruled that he's mentally incompetent. So, you know, even if you have a lot of money, you might not be safe.
Oh, that's absolutely true. It's all changing, and I guarantee you that this Elliot Rodgers mass murder spree is going to seal the deal for that, that people who have money are no longer going to be protected by their money when it comes to psychiatry. And again, the way the media is portraying this, that he had a psychiatric history, that he did not have a psychiatric history in terms of a psychiatric label. He was not diagnosed with schizophrenia or bipolar or any of this. He was diagnosed with a disorder, Asperger's, that doesn't even exist anymore. And the way that they are conflating these issues...
Adam Lanza is the same thing, and I know that people in the autistic community are very upset about this.
Yes.
But, you know, there are strong links to trauma that we
absolutely
know of.
I mean, he listed in his 130-page thing that I read every word of, he listed multiple places in early childhood that he experienced traumas that he pointed to as the reasons. The other thing is that they're trying to make this seem like this was not a calculated effort, that he was somebody who was out of his mind and didn't know what he was doing. He knew exactly what he was doing. And there were so many opportunities for the adults in his life, whether they be his family members or professionals or teachers or others, that could have interacted with him in different ways to have prevented this. But the planning of this murder spree that he went on lasted more than 2 years. And so,
been planning for 2 years?
Yeah, because he bought the first gun. He bought three different guns at three different times, and the first one was, I think, a year and a half to 2 years ago. And it was all done legally. Everything he did in purchasing those guns and so on and so forth was within the legal realms. And there are so many places where looking at what he wound up experiencing in terms of Hoyden, I think it was, that was talking about this idea of sexual entitlement, of his belief that that part of where he was coming out of a revenge place was because he wasn't, that he was still a virgin and that women weren't attracted to him. And really getting to issues of how men are presented in the society and the Hollywood movie land version of reality versus, the consensus reality that we're all sharing in. He just didn't have access to it.
The backlash to all of this, that a lot of women are coming out, and that the Twitter space has really lit up because, in fact, here in Washington, a Washington Post writer got a lot of grief because she was speaking about the expectation that Hollywood had of what happens when you go to college. Just recently this week, Harvard University is talking about, I think, 1 in 4, 1 in 5, whatever the data is, that females who attended Harvard are saying that they were sexually abused, and just the amount of expectation that males have of having the availability of sex at 18, 19, 20 years old. I mean, it's really, you know, unrealistic. I mean, this guy, his dream world was that at his age that he should have had a ready supply of females. And that probably set him up for improper expectations.
That was definitely part of it. I mean, another big part of it, which people aren't wanting to talk about, is that he was exposed to pornography as a young teenager and actually wrote about how troubling it was for him and how confused he was by it and how this was in part of what set off his understanding of how things were, and that he wrote, "I wish somebody would have explained to me what was happening to me." Because apparently his own sexuality was never addressed in a way that he at least felt adequate. Whether or not it was, you know, that people thought that they did, I don't know. But in his writings, he pointed to that as an issue. And so the access that young people have, this was while he was in the World of Warcraft world, 6 hours a day playing, you know what I mean? You know, playing in fantasy land, literally.
Sorry, explain that. What are you talking about?
I'm sorry?
What's this Warcraft world? What world was he in?
Oh, World of Warcraft. It's an online gaming thing where people of all ages game against each other virtually online. And the World of Warcraft series he was very, very interested in, and apparently very, very good at. And so it's something that, you know, it's like a video game, but it happens online where you have battles with people, you know, from anywhere else in the world.
Where he had this, he was spending 6 hours a day with these games online.
He was spending a lot of time at one of these, you know, internet cafes where he was first exposed to pornography. I think he was 13 or 14 years old. And he wrote about it as something that really both troubled him and disgusted him and excited him. And he didn't know how to deal with it. So his early impressions of what sex and sexuality were came, you know, in this kind of way. Where, and I think this happens to many people, and many people don't go becoming, you know, go off and go on murderous sprees. But for him, in his writings, this was an important piece that he consistently went back to and explained in depth about how he didn't understand what was happening with his sexuality, and that apparently when he tried to talk to people about this longing for intimacy and being close to people and developing relationships and wanting a girlfriend, everybody kind of brushed him off, you know. And so, and like the men that were in his life that were there to help him, according to him and in his writings, just made him feel worse because they had women hanging all over him. You know, but he also talked about in early childhood when his parents divorced and how difficult it was for him bouncing back and forth between two households and not really having the consistency and those kinds of things. And, you know, being a child where, you know, he was immigrated from England and at like 5 or 6 years old, and then had to adjust, and then his parents divorced soon after coming here, and then eventually his father became very successful, but then had a long period of where he wasn't very successful. So his ideas of money were also very convoluted, as to like being embarrassed to let his friends come to his mother's house because she lived in an apartment instead of a house. And I think that these are larger social structure issues that we really, nobody wants to deal with.
And we have to remember that this is one incident in an entire month, several months. This has been in wherein there have been single shootings of violence wherein where the callers who are here, people are listening in, they may have had incidents in their community, several of them, domestic violence, et cetera, lots of violence. And I just want to remind people that those who want to call in to talk, the phone number is 267-521-0167. Again, that's 267-521-0167. And you might want to grab a pencil and paper and have it by the phone as we talk about these things, because we will be giving you opportunities of how you can join the fight against the war on persons who have legal diagnosis, or even anyone, because Lauren, as you said on several broadcasts, that everyone is at risk for this because of the potential Murphy bill. And I want to alert people that there is going to be E-Fulatory and company will be on a NPR show on Monday early in the morning at 10:06. And I would recommend people listen to the show and call us later on Monday night as well, so we can strategize what we can do, and also to let the national public radio stations in your local area know how you feel about this. We can always vent ourselves, but we have to organize so that the press will ask the right kind of questions. My concern always is, whether it's CNN or NPR, are they, when they have these people on, are they asking the right kind of questions? Are they so immured? I mean, Lauren, if you had Tory in your studio right now, what question would you ask him?
I would really want to know how he sleeps at night. That's what I'd like to ask him. How did promoting this monstrous fraud in the media on individuals? How many people have seen him as their doctor? How does he sleep at night knowing that what he is promoting is not based on science, and that the way he's promoting it makes it sound like it's science? I'll tell you, the couple of psychiatrists who were at the presentation at Left Forum today who had some problems with things that people who were on the panel were saying, including me, it hit a note, and I wound up having to walk away from the conversation afterwards in the hallway, because when the good doctor was explaining to me how helpful it is that he gives his elderly women patients who have Alzheimer's ECT to cure their depression, and I really could say nothing else except, like, I really feel for the people that you're calling your patients.
I remember their sad memories.
it's just the lies.
Well, the only thing I would say is I'm trying to find out who's interviewing Tory, because on NPR, because my big beef is that we're not, like I said, that, you know, like I was a true believer too. I didn't get a good night's sleep until I was chemically knocked out at 39, 40 years old. But I know that the side effects from this are so great, it's not worth what you're getting out of it. And I just believe that people should have choice. And to Larry Drain just had a great article on his blog about how in Tennessee, for example, that there is no additional money, that they're not talking about additional monies for medical care. They're just talking about this judicial process that they'll have. And we're pushing more people that would say that they will be into the mental health system, but there's no additional money.
Right.
Not even, as Larry had said, not even in the, even when they want to have more hospitals and more draconian things, there's no money. You have to realize that if you want to have more people in a hospital, you've got to have brick and mortar place. And we're not even talking about, the staffing.
Right. And I think I just want to let people know, even if you're a first-time caller and you'd like to call in, you have something you'd like to talk about, please do. It's area code 267-521-0167. And, you know, we've talked a lot about Paula Kaplan's work on this show. And in 2011, she had an article come out in Psychology Today called Science Isn't Golden, Matters of the Mind and Heart. And, you know, one of the things she's pointing to is the 15 to 25-year loss of life that people on psychiatric drugs are experiencing. And she has this great section in it about informed consent, and that in order for informed consent to happen, that the doctor must, she says, learn about and disclose to the patient everything that is known about the potential benefits and potential kinds of harm that treatment carries. And two, the person recommending a treatment must learn and inform the patient about the whole array of things that have been helpful to those who have suffered in similar ways, not just the traditional medicalized approaches, but all approaches, Kaplan writes or wrote. And so I think that it's important to understand that with informed consent, I don't think anybody is arguing that somebody shouldn't be able to have a drug or take a drug, or that there's something wrong if somebody's choosing to take a drug. But people aren't generally informed of all of the potential side effects and risks of what these drugs are. And so that's one of the things that I feel like one of the reasons why Tori might have some trouble sleeping at night is because there really is not an informed consent process going on. And with involuntary treatments, it's not only not informed, but it's directly over somebody's objection.
I talked to Tori a couple of times in exchanges, and I don't think he has any trouble sleeping at night at all. Because he has no trouble sleeping at night. He believes that, for example, schizophrenia is caused by a virus that cats have put upon us. Cats,
I'm serious. Gandhi toxoplasma or toxoplasma Gandhi, that right from pregnant women handling cat feces, that it's then spread to the fetus, and that it lays dormant until they're about 18 or 20 years old.
He believes that, and that is for me is that it irritates me that the press don't question him on that. He really believes that. There's a cat virus, and he has another doctor that has gotten hundreds of thousands of dollars in research dollars.
Yogin, right? His co-writer, Yogin?
Yes, yes. He's gotten lots of money to perpetrate the fact that, not the fact, but the misinformation that cats are carrying the schizophrenia virus. And that is the reason why we have this widespread increase. I don't understand why, if he believes that, why doesn't he advocate for the elimination of cats?
I just want people to know, I just want to point people to the article if they're interested in it. It was published in Emerging Infectious Diseases, November 2003, Volume 9, Number 11. And the article is called Toxoplasma Gandhi and Schizophrenia, written by E. Fuller Torrey and Robert H. Yokin. The author affiliations include the Stanley Medical Research Institute in Bethesda, Maryland, and Johns Hopkins University Medical Center in Baltimore. the abstract, I'm just going to read it because I think it's people, you know, sometimes really think that we're exaggerating here when we're talking about this. But this is really what they're saying, is that recent epidemiological studies indicate that infectious agents may contribute to some cases of schizophrenia. In animals, infection with Toxoplasma gondii can alter behavior and neurotransmitter function. In humans, acute infection with T. gondii can produce psychotic symptoms similar to those displayed by persons with schizophrenia. Since 1953, a total of 19 studies on T. gondii antibodies in persons with schizophrenia and other severe psychiatric disorders and in controls have been reported. 18 reported a higher percentage of antibodies in the affected persons. In 11 studies, the differences were statistically significant. Two other studies found that exposure to cats in childhood was a risk factor for the development of schizophrenia. Some medications used to treat schizophrenia inhibit the replication of T. gondii in cell culture, establishing the role of T. gondii in the etiopathogenesis of schizophrenia might lead to new medications for its prevention and treatment. And so,
Lord, I'm going to tell you this. I have been reading what you said word for word from the Centers of Disease Control and Prevention.
Yes, it's published on the CDC's website.
December 2003. And I don't understand why, if he's said this many times, him and his friends, why haven't they called for the quarantining of pregnant women against? If you believe this is true, then you would put a warning out saying, if you're pregnant, don't be around cats. You seen any warning like that?
Only in old wives' tales have I seen warnings like that. I think that it's incredibly important for people to understand that in 2010, and this is published on PubMed, Tori and Jochen put forth another article of where they expose, Linda Andre published this in 2009 about the Nazi genocide and how they used people who had psychiatric labels to test the gas chambers on. Tori and Jochen ignored her work and put out this story on their own as if it was their original findings of this issue. But
I want people to know who are listening into us, because they might just think that we're off the wall, that if they go online and go to Google and put in emerging infectious diseases, Toxoplasma, Toxoplasma, that they will get what you got. Because when you were saying that, I was reading it word for word from the abstract.
Yes.
Word for word. And if that was the case, and who knows, it might be, if they felt so strongly about that, if Tori and others felt so strongly that this is causing schizophrenia, you know, I just say, well, you know, this is parallel to the plague when the rats were carrying things around. If you believe that, why would they not be strongly advocating as they advocate now for forced treatment, to say is that there would be a warning that if you're pregnant, you cannot be around cats. But I've never heard anybody say that.
It really is a fascinating argument to ask. And part of it is because it's not true. You know, they know it's not true. But yet they publish these things as if they have some leg to stand on. The article that was funded by the Stanley Medical Research Institute to discuss the psychiatric genocide of you know, 100,000 people in Germany. In this article, they do mention that there could be an infection at the source of the problem, and so I'm trying to get right to that line. But they say it is possible that such genetic variations may cause disease only if they are activated by life experiences such as perinatal hypoxia, nutritional deficiency, infections, or other environmental factors. And so,
you mean like trauma? Like trauma and things like that might cause it to be activated?
Yeah. But they while saying that there is no genetic proof, they say that there may be and that we should act as if there is. And I think that that's the big problem. I think that's the big problem with all of biological psychiatry, that they act as if this is a legitimate, scientific, established proof, and they just don't have that proof. But then they allow...
Can you give us, when you finish your sentence, can you give us your tip line? I know some people may have things that they think that you might want to be on your radio program and to also talk about your June 4th special that you're having.
Yes. If you know about a news tip that you'd like to have investigated or an idea for a show or you would like to be a guest on the show, you can call the tip line at area code 718-273-8708, area code 718-273-8708. And on June 4th, we're going to be having a special show at a special time, 8 to 10 p.m., that will be entirely focusing on electroshock as a crime against humanity. And guests on that show will include Sue Clark Wittenberg, Don Weitz, George Ebert, John Breeding, Brenda LeFrancois, Loretta Wilson, and others. And so it will be a real great mixture of people who are both survivors of electroshock and some PhDs who are working to try to expose it. We do have another caller on the line, area code 541. Are you there?
Hi, it's Dan again. Good to hear you.
Hey.
You're doing a great job.
Hey, thanks, Dan. How you doing?
Great. Dan Burdick and Eugene.
Great. Thank you for calling in. So we were just talking a little bit about Tori and...
Yes, I've been listening for a while. Yeah, very good.
Yeah, yeah. So what would you like to add?
Well, let's see. E. Fuller Torrey, I think he's a propaganda worker, and that when Stanley Research has a nice ring to it, but they've been talking about important research being underway since, say, 1970. That's just one of the things they say. We're scientific, and there is important research underway, but we don't know how to test for anything, so we just select people in the categories by descriptive categories voted for in a committee, which may be pretty good descriptive categories, but they are not diagnoses of any particular illness. And just as their symptom drugging, they make so much money off them, aren't curative or restorative and don't treat any particular illness. And so when he says Stanley Research is interested in cat viruses, I take that with a number of grains of salt, because I think that's just adding to the overall image that they are actually interested in science, when what they're actually interested in is selling Risperdal and Paxil.
I think that this is a really important point to be driving home to people about what it is they're doing and how it is they are supporting their treatment. I'm just on the Stanley Medical Research Institute's website right now, and I'm, you know, it's clear that this is about the, quote, brain. Their logo is a looks like an old phrenology map, actually.
People should go to their website. It's stanleyresearch.org. They really should go to their website and look at the treatment files and things they have, because the majority of I made a statement about this on a couple of your shows, Lauren, that there are people who are benefiting by these things. Stanley Medical Research does most of the research on schizophrenia, and most of the research. They fund a lot of the research on bipolar and schizophrenia in the United States and in Israel. So you really have to look at that. So universities that want to do research, they will come to the Stanley Medical Research Institute to get money.
Sure, there's probably a lot of money available, but why don't they have any results?
Well, they don't, because there's not really any results, because as Lauren says, there is no data to show that this is a real illness. There's no blood test. There's no blood.
It could be a real, real illnesses could exist, but notice that with their cat virus, they don't say, well, they ought to say, well, people shouldn't be diagnosed as schizophrenia. If having schizophrenia, they should be diagnosed as having a cat virus and treated for that. That's how the system works. Every category that is non-medical, so they can't find what the cause is, because those are non-medical descriptive categories based on word tests and behavioral report, and then they say, well, a person has ADHD or they're depressed or they have psychosis, and those are descriptions. They're not medical diagnoses, so they can't. They are not looking for a real thing. They just talk about doing research.
And one of the things that they do, if you look at their page on a public statement about the Stanley Brain Collection, they actually have brains that they give brain tissue to different researchers to pull apart and try to find things about. And this is apparently done through their nonprofit arm. They say, to our knowledge, the person obtaining consent explains the donation of the brain to the next of kin, and the consent forms have stated that the donation include brain tissue without limitation on the amount or size of the donated tissue. So there's a real underlying problem here about how this is getting pulled out of whose brains that they're actually studying in terms of this. And apparently people who have had tragically high incidences of sudden unexpected deaths occur among those, they say, who suffer from schizophrenia, bipolar, and severe depression. And they work with medical examiner offices because these offices receive cases of sudden death. So could you imagine that, like, you're a family member of somebody who dies suddenly, and next thing you know, you have the Stanley Medical Research Institute coming knocking on your door asking if they can have your loved one's brain so that they could do research on it.
I know other true believers hear their brains beforehand. They have selected before that, but I'm just suggesting that people go to their website and not believe what we're saying. Just go to their website and look and see what they're doing. Their treatment trials are all on pharmaceuticals. if you look at them, they all have pharmaceuticals. And they're not just in the United States. They're in British Columbia. They're in Germany. In fact, they have, next to the United States, they are involved in more research in Germany than in the United States. So it's Germany and the United States are neck and neck in New Zealand. And they really are, even though Tori plays a lot of lip service to schizophrenia, they're really doing a lot of research on the drugs for depression and bipolar illness, which most of us know, even they say for decades, they've been saying is this is very treatable. But their interventions are all chemical, and they take place in the U.S. and in Germany. And people don't have to believe what I'm saying or Lauren is saying. They just need to go to stanleyresearch.org. And they provide most of the money for research in this in the United States and Israel. And people should really pay attention to, when people speak, they should find out where their money is coming from when they're speaking, and what other things they're doing, and what other boards they serve on. And many times people do not do their research to find out, well, just exactly who is the Stanley Medical Research Institute.
So there was one picture of Tori where he's like wearing a lab coat, and there's a number of human brains, and he's like looking scientific, and then it speaks about all of the brains they have in their collection. So that's the biological model. We know what the problem is in the brain, so we have, and wacky E4 Tori has lots of brains, and he has his cat theory. But now, and he may be onto something, but the silly guy. But for the serious researchers, look to the National Institute of Mental Health, because they're doing the more serious research. But it's an open, fair game of inquiry, and we're all just very scientific, and we have an open American scholarship dialogue going on, and there's plenty of funding, and we're hot on the trail. It's 50 years later, but we are doing important research, like magnetic resonance imagery. And so at the National Institute of Mental Health, as Vera Sharov has brought attention to, they said, well, we're interested in our dopamine theory of too much dopamine in schizophrenia. So they took a group of their schizophrenics and yanked them off from the major tranquilizer antipsychotic drugs they were on, and then they gave them amphetamine. So, and then, like, all of the patients got worse after they gave them the dopamine and norepinephrine stimulating amphetamine after they'd taken them off from the tranquilizer, and they said, look, this is, pay us $1 million, we have just researched our dopamine hypothesis because we're so very scientific. We subjected a whole group of people to amphetamine and they all got worse. That supports our theory. So that is the level of deep research that you see with the more serious than E4 Tori National Institute of Mental Health.
Right, and
so
of course,
the whole
dopamine thing has been
the game.
Yeah,
and they make medication synonymous with patented drugging agent, and they make brain disease and illness synonymous with with psychological behavioral characterizations. Well,
yet
these
people are against affordable care. Most of these people who are for all this, they are against affordable care. That's what I don't understand. They're against affordable care that opens up Medicaid, which for most people who have a, I'm going to use the words in quote, diagnosis of some kind of mental illness, they, many of them go through the public mental health system, not everybody. And what feeds the public mental health system is Medicaid. And for them to be, for someone like Murphy and other conservative Republicans to be against affordable health care, which actually would open up access to people. And that's for some people who do believe that their people are having emotional stress. I'm a person who believes that people are having emotional stress, whether it's due to trauma or whether you say a brain injury or whatever it is. But there are people that are having that they seek help. But if you believe that, if you believe people honestly have, if you don't believe that mental illness is a farce, if you believe people are really suffering, and I think some people are suffering because they have trauma, why would you be against it's not a full single-payer system, but why would you be against broadening mental health and other health services to people? Why would you be against it? I mean, is it the fact that you just want to lock people up and control people in the community through having them be chemically lobotomized? And that's what it is. I saw that with my own father, who was in a VA hospital at Terry Point, where he was virtually a death from all the chemicals that they were giving him. And this is not, we're not having the plague like they had back in the middle century. I'm just urging people to please tune in to the NPR show and make your comment to NPR. And usually the best way to do that is through giving them some kind of a letter writing or burning their telephone lines.
Right.
Because the press... Yes, Laura.
Oh, no, I'm agreeing with you, and I think that people should definitely write in to NPR and let them know your opinion and let them know you're listening and how you feel.
I know that they're having somebody from National Disability Rights, which I think that's a kudos to them having another side on there. But CNN, ABC, NBC, all of these stations, they need to be able to have someone else on who can give them another view. I mean, this is NPR doing this, having somebody from National Disability Rights is a good thing. I just hope that they have a very strong person on there who's knowledgeable.
Yeah, and I want to just mention something about the trauma-informed peer support. There's an excellent guidebook that's been produced published by the National Association of State Mental Health Program Directors on engaging women in trauma-informed peer support. And I think that people maybe to familiarize yourself with it. And it was written by Andrea Blanche, Beth Filson, Darby Penny, with contributions from Kathy Cave. And it can be found at the National Association of State Mental Health Program Directors website, which is www.nasmhpd.org. That's nasmhpd.org /engaging women. /engaging women.aspx. Or if you just put in trauma informed care and NASMHPD in your Google search, it'll come right up. But it goes through a lot of really important aspects. And so it gives an introduction to trauma and trauma-informed practices. And then chapter two really focuses on, am I a trauma survivor, and looking at what is trauma and how do people experience it. Chapter three, I think, is excellent, which has a piece on peer support fundamentals. So if you're just getting exposed to this idea of peer support and as an alternative, that gives you a really good idea of some of the basics about what peer support is and how it operates. There's a great chapter on culture and trauma, and another really great chapter on religion, spirituality, and trauma. And I think the entire thing is really fabulous, but something that people may not know exists, and you might want to go check it out, because the trauma-informed care.
It's been out there for a couple of years. I know both. I've met both Kathy Cave and Darby Penny. And I would say, even though it is written for women, I would say that it's excellent for men as well. I've printed it. It's in a PDF format, so you can print it off. I can't imagine anyone who is themselves working with people who've had trauma or who is a trauma survivor not knowing about this. But, you know, things do go under the radar screen, and it's the National Association of Mental Health Program Directors. And you can very easily print it off or either send it to a USB so you can have it. I mean, it's fantastic. I can say anyone who's working with people who have mental health issues, because most of us are coming from a background where we had trauma in our life. Or if you're a trauma survivor, I would say Darby Penny and Kathy Cave, I mean, they've done a fantastic job of doing this. And, you know, this speaks also to what many people try to say, that I know that one of the pet peeves of Tori is that there's a trauma industry. Sure, there is a trauma industry. There are people that are creating trauma for people. But if you want to help people, I think the best thing to sometimes is not to go through the mode of what's wrong with you, it's what happened to you. Because I know in my life, we have lots of traumatic events, and I'm not talking about, you know, you lost your job or whatever. I'm talking about horrific things that have happened, and the Women's Trauma Workbook that is on the National Association of Mental Health Planning Directors website. It doesn't cost you anything. You can just download it and go through it yourself, for yourself or for other people. I know there's people on this line. We get people call in who are in the profession, where they're nurses or social workers. If you don't know what to do, I would strongly urge that you download this information. I can't remember how many pages. What is it, about 45 pages? How many pages is it, Lauren? Do you remember?
It may be longer than that. It's like 13 chapters or 14 chapters, I think. It's 13 chapters. And so it's comprehensive. And I think that your point about it being good for people regardless of gender is very important to note, because certainly...
Hurry up, and some of these things I say, it's been out there more than a year. Sometimes I say, get it, because it may not be up there. I know that the... I would say download it, print it. I've downloaded it as a PDF and sent it to my local Kinko's and had multiple copies made so we can distribute it to people. I mean, it's a fantastic resource. I can't see anyone working with people who have emotional distress not using this very valuable tool. I mean, you need to have it in your library if you're working with people who have emotional distress. If you yourself have had trauma in your life, you want to have it. If other people, it's unfortunate because of the controversy we have with people think that Samson is some kind of wild, loose place, but it's unfortunate that something like this is not taken on by SAMHSA, that SAMHSA has not printed it out. I know that Tori and these other people make like that there is a trauma culture that's out there, but it's real. When you are in a school or workplace and you have a shooter come in, just like the people in California or somewhere else, these are real traumas. We have real traumas that happen to us in our lives, and they affect how we look at everything, and we should really look for this.
This is Dan. So do you know people that have done this work and benefited from it and restored their health, and their cases have improved, have gotten better able to get along in life and gotten well themselves and on the right track again?
Yes. Yes, myself included. I think that once a trauma-informed model is put in place, the entire conversation changes from what's wrong with you to what happened to you. And when you start to ask people about what happened to them as opposed to pointing out all of the perceived deficits that somebody may have or the limitations on somebody's life, all of a sudden things open up and there's an endless amount of possibility, along with an extreme amount of emotional difficulty in working through trauma issues themselves. You know, let's not kid anybody that working through trauma is painful, but well worth the pain. It's a different kind of pain than being drugged and subdued all the time. And I think that the work that Darby and Andy Blanche and Kathy Cave and Beth Philbin did on this is really quite incredible and reaches to new levels in helping people be able to open up to new places. It looks like it's about 90-some-odd pages long, Yvonne. I finally got it all into one PDF because I usually open it in sections. But I do think that using a trauma-based perspective of when interacting with people really opens up doors for hope. And there's resources that are available in it. Also, and ways that people can connect, you know, and that this is a social action issue. Two out of every three girls and one out of every three boys in the United States will be physically or sexually abused before their 16th birthday. Upwards of 96% of people in state-operated psychiatric facilities have childhood histories of abuse or neglect. And so these kinds of things, especially if they happen in formative years, can really affect the way one interacts with the world. And what might be...
We're silent about it. People are silent like they're ashamed, you know. But people are... these are not the people who are the victims of trauma. It's the other people that are around them. You know, and... people ask why is there an explosion of mental illness in this country? And the explosion has to do with two things. It has to do with pharmaceutical companies wanting not having a customer that they didn't like, and also because there's an assault on women and children in this country. And I'm not debating the fact that men are assaulting as well, but these are two strong indicators when you have a chemical industry, and that's what I'm referring to, pharmaceuticals, who never have met a person who is not a customer. And also the fact that women and children are disrespected. And when I say children, I mean male and female. They're totally disrespected. So you have someone that is under the age of 14 and they have such bad memories. It's not saying that everyone that comes out of having those bad memories is going to be a mass murderer, because most of them are. I mean,
and if anything, again, more likely to be a victim of a crime than a perpetrator. I think that that's something that Tori and all of them would like to have wiped out of the reality of the conversation, and they try very hard to wipe it out. But, you know, I'm just looking at this New York Times article from, what day is this? This is from last year, from August 19th, 2013. And so maybe part of where they get that statistic out of one of every five Americans has a psychiatric history is because, according to the New York Times, fully one in five Americans take at least one psychiatric medication. And so perhaps the way they're delving out how many people are experiencing being psychiatrized is by how many people are taking the drugs. And so when you think about one out of every five Americans taking at least one psychiatric medication, that is an awful lot of drugs that are coming out to. And this data comes out of America's State of Mind, a report by Medco, and where they're looking at national trends for how many people are experiencing different things. And so apparently this psychiatric drugging, the medication trends, antidepressants are one of the top ones, of course, with the SSRIs. And the SSRIs, we must continue to acknowledge how they are directly linked to suicidality and violence, and that this is not something that is necessarily in a person, but that a drug can produce. Just because they're prescribed doesn't mean that they're any safer or more effective than street drugs. And people need to really put that into their equation and go do your own research. I just want to give out the number if you'd like to call in. It's area code 267-521-0167, area code 267-521-0167. Dan, if I could follow on something that you had brought up before about the patents.
Yeah.
Could you talk about that a little bit? Because you sound like you... about how this works and with the patents on psychiatric drugs and how they how long they last or what the process is. Do you have some insight into that?
Patents seem to last a long time, don't they? They last for years, and then they try to get around the patents expiring by finding a new indication, a new thing to treat it with. With Prozac, Mother Jones had an article, Disorders Made to Order, and Prozac's patent was up, and they came out with, they put the same chemical in a pink pill, and then they came up with a diagnosis of premenstrual dysphoric disorder, and said, "Well, that's our new diagnosis, and we have a new drug to treat it. It's pink. It's called."
Like I said, they never met a customer that they didn't like.
Well, they had a new trade name. They had a new trade name, Seraphim or something, so they give it a new trade name and got a new patent on it for the new disorder and a new drug. It's a new drug, and they're going like, has the same chemical as Prozac. That's a new drug for a new disorder. So they got a new patent that way. And so the game is, if it's statin drugs, you want to get a new molecule that is as effective as the previous molecules, and it doesn't have to cure anything. If it suppresses symptoms, then it's as effective or more effective than the other ones, and is about as safe. people don't drop dead in the 6 weeks that they test, then you can get a then the FDA can give you a patent and for your intellectual invention of the new molecule. So what they want to do is get a blockbuster molecule. They'll make them $1 billion in a year or two, and so that's the whole name of the game in medicine these days. Now that the drug companies have swamped it. And there's a good book, Our Daily Meds. So that
Our Daily Meds?
Our Daily Meds. That's a good book.
Our Daily Meds. Yeah, and that, but that's what it's like for many people. I mean, if you have 20 to 25% of the country on a psychiatric drug that they're taking at least once or who knows, maybe twice or three times a day, it does become this is a daily existence for people. And I, you know, also understand that some people who may, you know, really come to rely on these drugs don't understand the long-term effects, and nobody understands the long-term effects of these because they weren't tested by the FDA for more than 6 or 8 weeks before they were released to the public. And so you've got people on these drugs for decades without really knowing what the outcome is going to be.
I know they've been doing some research earlier because someone had said this to me this week, is that the federal and state governments aren't protecting children. They're in foster care. There are many children who are in foster care, and they're in foster care because their parents either are deceased or for some reason that they're not there and they are there to get care. And that there's a high percentage of these children who are taking pharmaceutical medications. And the federal government has been very there. I mean, an overabundance of them are on pharmacy-type medications. And I know that it sounds strange for me saying pharmacy-type medications. They have pharmacy chemicals that they're taking. And it's just horrible that our government is not protecting these children and that they are on a higher dose than other children are.
Right, and you know, in this Medco report that showed the one out of every five Americans, they rate risks to children. Increased use of atypical antipsychotics, especially among children, may be due to the fact that they are seen as less dangerous than older antipsychotics and can be helpful for conditions that were previously treated with other medications. However, these drugs are not without their risks. There is evidence that the risk of diabetes and metabolic disorders from using atypical antipsychotics could be much more severe for pediatric patients than adults, and there's a need for more studies to understand the long-term effects of these drugs on children. Some of these drugs have warning labels regarding the possible exacerbation or increased risk of new onset diabetes, although the metabolic side effects appear to be somewhat different for each drug. But we know that this is what we're doing to these children. So when you see the reports that there's this rise in obesity among children in the United States, how many of these children are being put on these drugs that cause diabetes, that cause a 60, 80, 100-pound weight gain in under 2 months? You know, who is doing that research? And why aren't we, as a society, demanding that before psychiatry can put their clutches all over our children, that they need to have evidence for what it is that they're purporting?
The thorazine-type major tranquilizers, they cause progressive brain damage, and so the so-called atypicals are more of the same. Since thorazine came out in 1950, it blocks dopamine 2 receptors in the brain, and that's the brain reward circuitry. So if you're interested in something, then you pursue it. And so taking the drugs, it's called a major tranquilizer or like a chemical straitjacket. It takes away your interest in whatever you're thinking about or concerned with or undertaking. And so it makes a person apathetic, and it drugs the brain. And so like Thorazine or Haldol. And then Risperdal, they said, well, it has a novel form of action, and it's much safer. We'll call it an atypical because it's much different. It's more disease-specific, and it's a breakthrough. But it was still a dopamine 2 receptor blocker. So they were basically lying. It wasn't
right.
A breakthrough. And like all the others, if you minimize the dose and you make sure the person's as well as possible and take vitamin supplements, it might not be too harmful, but they have zero interest in taking care of people's health. They just want to sell their drug. So if you give a child something that blocks one of the nerves, they have a developing brain. You're giving them something that's neurotoxic that blocks a neurotransmitter at the receptor level. It's like that's something to give to an adult for a day or a week or a month. It's not something you're supposed to be giving to a toddler permanently.
Right. And I think that, you know, people can't grasp their heads around how they can be putting these babies on these heavy, sedative, mind-altering, brain-damaging drugs that are also doing a ton of damage to the body and also interfering with social experience in a significant way. I mean, you know, the idea of a children being drugged, I mean, your entire social situation is then mediated by a drug that you are always on. And it's very important that people do their own research into this. The number, if you'd like to call in, is area code 267-521-0167. 267-521-0167. I'd like to point to a thing on Psych Central written by Dr. John Grohl, who has consistently for the last several years been putting out a table of the top 25 psychiatric medication prescriptions. And, you know, for the last, from 2005 to 2013, it seems like there are five or six main drugs that have been competing for the top spots. And so consistently from 2005 until 2013, the first ranked drug has been Xanax, which is reported to be used for anxiety. And there have been 48,465,000 prescriptions for Xanax written. The next is Zoloft with 41,416,000 prescriptions, Celexa with 39,445,000, Prozac 28,258,000 prescriptions, Ativan 27,948,000 prescriptions, and Dezeril 26,242,000 prescriptions. 26,242,000. So that's 50, 100, 140, 170, 200, 230 million prescriptions written on six different drugs. So when we're talking about that, the country is on drugs. And that these are, just because they're pharmaceutical doesn't make them any less mind-altering. And in fact, their intention is to alter the mind in the way that one thinks. It's just almost mind-boggling to get your head around what you're looking at 230. And that's only the top six. If you really add up all of the prescriptions of all of the different drugs that have been used, that are being used, it's just outrageous. The top 20, the 25th top most prescribed drug is Prestique, with 3,217,000 prescriptions. So there's not, you know, even when you get to the 25th top ranked drug, it's still in the millions of prescriptions that are being written. And I just really think that we need to figure out how to get to the mainstream media to start calling attention to these things and getting our perspective up front and in the mainstream media. So if you have any ideas on how to do that, that would be great. And I think what Yvonne was talking about earlier, like when Tori is going to be on NPR at 10:06 is it Monday morning, Yvonne? May have lost Yvonne for a moment. I think it's
10:06.
I'm still here.
Oh, okay. So is it June 2nd at 10:06 a.m. that Tori is going to be on NPR?
Yes, that's correct. And I would suggest that people listen in, and they can go to your npr.com and see where it is going to be in your market, because NPR is a national radio program, and you want to be able to see where it's being serviced there, and you want to be able to speak up. And as I said, even for this radio broadcast, that people should be there with pen and pencil, and take notes and note where the press is not asking questions. I frankly think the press is intimidated because Tory's initials behind his name, and also that DJ Jassy actually is a creature who gives information to the news media, and they consider him to be an authority. And
yeah,
no one has ever questioned it. Just as a gentleman that head up the House, you usually people just give disclaimers to say, well, we received money from this and that. They don't have these disclaimers that are there. There are a lot of people that have a lot of, will become very rich if money is taken away from public mental health and put into institutionalization. And people say how that is because they're experts that testify at forensic hearings. There's all kinds of ways. There's an unsightly amount of money that's involved in perpetuating the myth that there is somehow a biological or chemical illness. But no one has said. The closest I've come to that was that researchers at NIMH, they claim, for example, that the schizophrenia gene is on the same address as the insulin gene. That's why it's no mistake. It's on purpose that many medications cause people to gain weight. And that's because the drugs are designed that way. They're designed to make you have a feeling of not being full. But I would suggest that people go to NPR.com and see where that program is. A link to the NPR station is going to be on Lauren Tenney's Twitter page. And I would make good use of NPR's Twitter page. When we've had instances here, I just happen to live, the Washington Post is our local paper. I find that if you give them information many times, that they will do a little bit more investigation. Right now, people are so intimidated by the recent massacre. We're going to have another one. I hate to say this, but we're going to have another one. And they use this for fuel. No one says anything about if they truly believe that this is a mental health issue. No one says anything about giving additional dollars to services for people. And I would just make sure that you get pencil and paper in hand to take notes, and also you get a stamp so that you can send letters to National Public Radio and your local television stations as well when they have stories like this, because right now it's almost like they've just given up and they listen to what Tori and Jaffe say as if it is Bible gospel.
Yes.
When is this show happening? And is it on the 2nd? When on the 2nd of June?
It's 10 o'clock on Monday, and there'll be a link on Lauren's Twitter page, so that people want to follow it, they can go to NPR, and Tori is going to be the guest.
We'll get it out, and it may change from listening market to listening market depending on the time. But in the D.C. area, it'll be on at 10:06 in the morning, and we'll make sure to put it out there. And I just want to say, you know, Yvonne's brought this up before about handwritten letters, and it is so rare because everybody is so electronically mediated now, and everything happens through email and Twitter and everything. It's not as common that people get just an old-fashioned handwritten letter addressed to an editor or addressed to a public official that really will show the humanness behind who it is that you are. It's not just another one of 10,000 emails that can be, you know, organized through and cataloged and not really paid attention to. But there's something very powerful about a handwritten letter to these people in power. And so, it doesn't even have to be long. I mean, and even when you're writing letters to the editor, they want 250, 300 words. So sometimes the shorter the statement, the more chances it has of getting published in a letter to the editor than if you write some very long, in-depth kind of piece, because they need something that is, reflective that they can print in a small amount of space. And so
Yvonne, pointing out this one show. Now, Frank Blankenship was saying that if you're dealing with someone online, if you're in an online forum, if you have, like, someone with you that's also addressing it at the same time, then you, like, support each other, and it becomes, like, a...
Absolutely, and that's why you can get on the...
NPR, for example, when
they have this, they'll have it broadcast as well. So even if you're not in, it's WAMU, WAMU, for the Washington area, but if not, they will also have it where you can go and just like we do on the Lauren Penny Show, where you can go and you can hear it, and you can make comment. I found here with the Washington Post is that the most newspapers now, larger newspapers, not your weeklies, have a blog. And you can influence their investigation of a particular area of interest if you make comments. So they will see if they print a story and they have it in their blog and they ask, they have a area for you to comment and there's no comments coming in. If they get 30 or 40 comments, then somebody else who is the supervising editor for that, they will do an additional story. I've actually, when we've had little short stories that's been two or three pages, find out who the writer of the story is. I see now in the last week or so there's been a flurry of articles in the Wall Street Journal and other places. Find out who, look at the byline and see who's writing them. And also look at and see what they've written before, what their stance has been. And whether it's coming out of a crime report or health beat or local politics, see who the editor is so you can address it to them. So if you feel as though they're not covering it correctly or they're not covering all sides of it so that you can send something in. Editorial boards, for example, a lot of times they do not have people on the editorial boards who have any knowledge of mental health.
And yet they're writing all about it.
In other words, this is a good thing to have a party. I saw online where Diane Angster in Virginia, where they had a group of people that got together to stuff the Murphy Bill. Get people on a Friday or Saturday night, get them together and say, look, we're going to write letters into our congressperson, the editors. It's sometimes very helpful to people who don't know all of the, that are very passionate about this, we may really know all the intricacies, but people don't really realize how damaging this is. And to discuss it, to have a discussion or forum about it, I mean, an open discussion. They don't have to agree with everything we say, but they need to be informed of what's happening. And also, if they want to take action, you know, to help people, to not putting words in their mouth of what they're to write, but so they'll know what it is, so they can know that they can be empowered. A lot of times, we protect, and we don't have to let that happen. We can be involved there. And this is a good forum for people to talk about it as well. I know a lot of times people listen, and it takes them a little while for them to feel like they can talk, but, you know, gather around. If you say it's a Wednesday or Thursday evening, have other people come over and listen to the Lauren Tenney show and to maybe call in with questions and stuff that they have, or because this is going to affect us. It's going to affect everyone. It's not just people who have mental health challenges or trauma challenges. If you look at someone like the guy who was the head of the Clippers, if they can tell him, oh, look, you're mentally incompetent and you can't block the sale of your own company, I mean, it's ripe for abuse. Right.
Casey Kasem just ruled mentally incompetent and that his children now have say over what happens to him. There's nobody who's excluded from this judgment of psychiatry anymore. And if we want to drastically change our society to not have everybody, I mean, I sat in policy meetings 10 years ago at the State Office of Mental Health in New York, of where the leadership was saying, well, we can get rid of the discrimination if everybody is diagnosed with something. And
really?
While the state is saying that the switchover from mental health centers to behavioral centers isn't as nefarious as I suggest it is, I truly believe that because they have no evidence for a biological, quote-unquote, you know, mental illness, that they have switched the language to behavioral health because everybody has behavior. And so with this Affordable Care Act, like Patrick Kennedy says, everybody's going to be scheduled for a checkup from the neck up. And so substance use screenings, mental health screenings, in your primary care office, you are not going to be able to get around them. And when people start answering honestly about struggles they may be having or emotional crises or economic issues or different things that they may be struggling with, not realizing that they're in the process of being evaluated. And when the next step is that a physician says, well, why don't you take these drugs? And then the next step is a person saying, well, I don't want to take drugs. Then what? And then that's when we're going to be maybe being able to reach out to society, because then the larger strains of society are going to be affected by this.
It might be too late. Yeah, by that time, Lauren, it might be too late because...
Well, that's the big fear. And, you know, David Oakes told me a couple of summers ago that in the 70s that they called this. They said, you know, they may be here for us now, but they're coming for you. And they are coming. And they want everybody controlled and you know, and they want many, many people medicated. And that is just, especially with the children. If you'd like to call in, the number is area code 267-521-0167. Want to just say that you're listening, want to ask a question, have an idea of something you'd like to talk about, 267-521-0167.
Lauren, I just want to ask you this there. I see that you have some initials behind your name now. You're graduating or getting your PhD soon?
I've got it, yeah, but the official graduation is on Tuesday, so I'll be all signed and sealed officially.
So you'll be Dr. Kenny?
In psychology, and my specialization is environmental psychology, which is a wonderful little discipline that really looks at how environments affect people and how people affect environments. The bulk of my research was on state-sponsored organized psychiatric industries and power and oppression. And liberation and hope and people being able to get out. But one of the main things that my research showed, if I could just say for a second, was that when people speak out against the psychiatric industry, when they're working in these peer roles, that they are routinely sanctioned and retaliated against. And in the data that I collected, that retaliation included things like being fired from their job, losing access to their information, or not being able to move around as freely as they had before, all the way to being drugged and being reinstitutionalized. And so if you're listening and you work in the peer industry and you may be afraid to speak out because of your position, you may be afraid that you might lose your job or your organization might lose your funding, know that this is something that really does happen, but there are ways that you can still speak out, and that's one of the reasons why I've set up the tip line. If somebody wants to talk to me offline or report something anonymously, the number for that is area code 718-273-8708, 718-273-8708 to report a news story or an anonymous tip, or if there's something that you would like me to and people to be talking about on air, that's another way that you can reach out to me when we're not on air. Because some people definitely have good reason for not being able to be public about their experiences or the way that they're seeing things, because funding is so tightly wound up in it. And so that's I think something that people need to know, that they're, and the other side of it is, if you are being silenced in your workplace, if you are being told that you can't say certain things, to be able to point to this research in saying that this is not something specific to this organization that we're experiencing, but this is something that happens because of these roles. And that it's larger than just the organization. And so what I'm calling it is a national epidemic, because everywhere we went, all over the country, whoever we spoke to, this issue of people being silenced when they tried to speak out about human rights was prevalent.
I'm not silenced, but there is tentative things that occur to you. I know this personally, up close and personal, that there are tentative things that happen, and I'm just going to say, not on the tip line, but this might be a future radio to talk about how it was a good idea that I guess that we had peer specialists, but it's become corrupt, and hopefully that maybe sometime down the line, that some individuals who work in the role of peer specialists, I've never done that. They won't even allow me, even though I was a project manager for two peer specialist classes, to be grandfathered in. And I don't feel it's a bad thing, because I don't think that I could promote some of the things that they're talking
right.
about.
Well, that's, and I think at some point we should be having a show because people have expressed interest to me about what's going on with this new national standard to accredit people who are working in peer roles, because now they've managed to get the peer supports Medicaid fundable, and so how does that affect what was supposed to be a natural non-hierarchical kind of relationship between people who have had a shared experience, helping each other, mutually supporting each other to get to meet their goals, that is now going
to
be something that is funded and Medicaid reimbursable. And I think a lot of people have a lot of concerns about what it's going to look like when that happens. And so we're worried about it. But I also want to say that I'm a psychiatric survivor, and that my initial involvement in all of this 20-some-odd years ago was because of my own experiences of being locked up in the system. And, you know, when I was discharged when I was 18 from the adolescent outpatient program that I was forced to be in for 2 years after being institutionalized, it was written in my medical charts that I should not go to college and that I should, you know, take my drugs and go to program. And had I listened to them, that is exactly where I would be today. I'd be dead now. I know I would be dead now. There's no two ways around it. And I would have lived out, you know, the rest of my days as a mental patient, complying and believing that I needed to be on these drugs and I needed these things. And so, you know, 3 master's degrees and a PhD later, I kind of want people to understand that if you're being told something, if you have a dream about what you want your life to be like, if you want to be a writer, if you want to be a politician, whatever you want to be, that you should not let the people who are in the psychiatric role in your life tell you that you can't do it. Because the only thing that's going to stop you from being able to do what you want to do is whether or not you pick yourself up every day and try again. And going through school, it was hard. It was incredibly difficult. It was very, very strenuous on me in many ways. But watching these human rights violations and not being able to speak about it is harder. And so I really want to just, if you're listening and you're being told that your goals or dreams are too stressful for you or that you can't do those things or that they're delusions or whatever, don't buy it. And set yourself to achieve what it is you want in your life and that you can get whatever you want out of your life based on what you put in it, and to not let these people tell you that you can't do otherwise. We do have another caller from area code 609. Are you there?
Yeah, this is Jason.
Hey, Jason, how you doing?
Hi, okay, I called the other night. I just wanted to say something about the peer specialist thing that they're you know, going to cover now with insurance, because I recently signed up to go to that, to go to a training here in Burlington County, New Jersey, which is north of me in North Jersey. I'm way down south, but I signed up and I did about five trainings. We started out with RAP, and then there were about 60 people, and then they narrowed it down to about, I think, 25 of us after we studied the RAP stuff, which I think is pretty good. But I got out of it. Not only could I not do the work because I'm impaired, I couldn't do the assignments and the homework on time and because of other life problems, but I got out of it. They were just training us to be part of a treatment team. I got out of it. I was kind of disgusted when I realized what they were sort of doing. Are you there?
Yeah, no, I'm here, and I'm just thinking
okay.
about what you shared with
yeah.
us the other night, and how
yeah.
much you have to offer people, and the mutual support that you could, and
yeah.
this is why it's such a bastardization.
Well,
it
yeah.
really.
Yeah.
They corrupt.
That's exactly it. That's what I wanted to do. I mean, I heard about it. I don't even remember how. But, you know, and after the electroshock, I just, you know, I want, my idea of being, you know, being a peer would be helping people avoid any kind of psychiatry. So, and I thought I could play some role as an independent, you know, person going in and giving people unbiased information about treatments, but really they were just kind of, I mean, something, it was valuable, because I wanted to just complete the training, and then I could qualify somewhere, but I just couldn't do it. My conscience wouldn't let me do it. I don't want to, I didn't want to put myself in that situation where I'd be on a, you know, part of a treatment team. And
don't think that you're left because of this, because many people that we can't sleep well at night. Want us to not help people to recover, but they want us to walk people step by step into things that they don't want. Not to have informed consent.
And I didn't really, you know, when I was there at these trainings, it was like 8 hours a day, and the whole time I just wanted to talk about what had happened to me and what it had done and how it was functioning and not really functioning well and from the treatment directly. And, you know, but I never really got a chance to, and they were kind of, you know, the people running it were willing to accommodate me, and I explained to them I was having memory and cognitive problems as a result of the procedure,
and the
they were willing. Yeah, the ECT, and you know, and I was and like I said, you know, and all the drugging I'd been on, you know, I was damaged from that already. Already having memory problems and kind of physically not well and stuff, but you know I hope that I could do something for them but there just wasn't an opportunity to get to talk about my point of view that people can be healthy without these terrible drugs and other procedures
that modify
our brains.
Yeah, and I think what you're talking about is the exact problem that we're seeing all over the country with these, you know, pure positions that are being established, is that it's so far away from the original intent of what our movement was about. And people who aren't exposed to the dangers of psychiatry or who, you know, are still in that place of where they believe what they're being told about themselves and the drugs, are just being eaten up by these programs and taken, and so they become like the role model consumers who are then to guide other people to becoming consumers, you know, and we're not consumers, we're people. And so, Jason, I'd like to, you know, say to you, like, maybe we can talk offline, but there are opportunities through, like, Mind Freedom International and the Mental Patients Liberation Alliance that has a support line that's always looking for people to, you know, volunteer to be on the phone and talk to people who may be calling. There are non-governmental, non-funded, true values, support situations for people to be able to share these experiences, just like what you were talking about. Because as much as it's helpful to somebody who may be calling, it's also helpful to us when we can give something back and to be able to share what it is that's happened to us and maybe give somebody hope and strength through our own messages. And so if you're interested in being involved in any of that, please do get in touch with me offline and we can set something up and, you know, maybe even, you know, I'm not sure if Mind Freedom even has an established thing in Jersey or not, but...
I don't think they do. That's what I've been... I have contacted them and I filled out some form to, make, you know, to a volunteer thing, but they never got back to me, and there's no one... There's nothing in New Jersey. I'm not sure about Pennsylvania, which would be doable for me. But I am trying.
Well,
you know, I would like. I would definitely like to do something like that. And I have been planning on getting back to you. And I've listened. You know, I've been listening. So
I appreciate it.
Very important that people hook up. I mean, we have. It's very important that people be hooked up like this because. We may have to have an underground railroad when it comes out, but
landing spots. I also have a. I just want to say there's also a caller on from 845. Your line is open if you want to jump in.
Hi, Lauren. It's Anthony from Rockland County, New York.
Hey, Anthony. How you doing?
Hi. Good. How are you?
Good. You're on the phone with Jason and Yvonne and myself at the moment on air.
Hi, Jason. Hi, Yvonne.
So you
hey.
So do you have an update for us?
Oh, yeah. Actually, I do. I had called just for the people that don't know my own personal situation. I'm on AOT, which is Assistant Outpatient Treatment in New York State. And I've been on AOT for, it's basically involuntary outpatient commitment for people that aren't familiar with what AOT is for in New York State. And I've been on it for two and a half years. And recently I was told 3 months ago that they were renewing it for 3 months. And after the 3 month renewal, it wasn't going to be renewed. And I had two documents saying that they weren't going to have it renewed. But my psychiatrist the other day told me that they're thinking about renewing it for a whole year, which I don't understand why, because I have two documents saying that they weren't, and I had multiple people telling me that they weren't going to renew it, but the reason I asked him why they were going to renew it, and he said that it wasn't signed by the psychiatrist, my documents that said that they weren't going to renew it. So they've been lying to me the whole time.
God.
Mm-hmm. So that's what happened with that. Where I am, we had open-ended AOT for years up until about 10 years ago. It's something you do not want to have. You do not want the feds involved. It's just the outpatient treatment. You do not want to have those court orders. My heart goes out to you. I don't it doesn't make any sense to force people into treatment. Especially sometimes people are being forced that are already into treatment. It's just that they're being very specific. What does your treatment call for? Can I ask if you don't feel comfortable?
I feel comfortable. I'll tell you what it is. It's basically I have a court ordered therapist I have to see twice a week. I mean twice a month, once every other week. And I also have to have monthly injections of antipsychotics. I'm on Abilify, but I'm also taking it orally, too, and he wants me to just go on the injections. But, and I also have to meet with an intensive case manager every couple days.
So you have a therapist twice a week, and do you have any problems in that service, or that's not a problem?
Excuse me?
Do you have any problem getting that service? In other words, the court can say that, but what I'm asking is, does the county or state comply and give you that service?
No, it's court ordered. Yeah, they provide it through the county.
You're on an injectable, and they want you to be only on injectables.
Yeah, that's right.
Did you go to court? Is this done? Or is this coming still? Is your date still coming close?
The court date is going to be coming up probably in another two and a half weeks. The only glimmer of hope I do have was the thing was I switched psychiatrists recently because I was going to Summit Park Hospital and up here in Rockland, and that closed down. So that psychiatrist that I was seeing was transferred to another place, and I was seeing a new psychiatrist, but the old psychiatrist basically gave me his word that they weren't going to renew it, and I had to sign a release saying that the psychiatrist that I'm seeing now could talk to the other psychiatrist, and maybe, hopefully, the old psychiatrist I was seeing stands by his word, and the old psychiatrist stands by his word and backs me up a little bit. But I don't think so. I think I think the old psychiatrist that was seeing me is probably going to say, it's out of my hands now, it's your case, I don't work for the county anymore, and they're probably going to, and then the new psychiatrist I was talking to was telling me that he's going to renew it for a whole year no matter what, if that's the case, which I think
so
is...
Despite
right.
all of the efforts that you've made, everything that you've been doing to, you know, get your life to where you want it to be, the support that you have from family and friends, none of it is being held up because there's a psychiatrist who is dictating out to you that he needs you in his grasp.
Basically, yeah. Like I've done everything they've asked me to do. I've been complying with everything they've asked me to do. I've showed up to all my appointments pretty much like a half an hour on time, like before I was supposed to be there. I've been doing everything they've been asking me of, and I've been told by multiple people that they weren't going to renew it, and I have two documents saying they weren't, but meanwhile they're going to go back on their word. And I'm disappointed and angry, but I'm not surprised that they did this, because I've heard the stories of this happening to other people. And I hear that it's really hard to get off AOT, like it's near impossible. So I'm afraid this is going to drag out for years, for me.
That is just something else. It is really just unconscionable of the way that they're going about doing this. If there's any kind of supports that we can provide you, having somebody, you know, at the court while the hearing is on, so then they know people are watching or anything, please, you know, let's talk offline and see if there's some way that we can assist so that you have some support going through this. I think that what's happening to you, Anthony, is really something that is happening to, you know, tens of thousands of people across this country
now.
And people, for people who are listening, to understand that it doesn't matter what you do, that they still say that you haven't done enough. And at what point are they going to, you know, loosen their grasp? And the idea of being faced with an injectable drug that lasts for, 30 days or something like that, that's on a time release. And so
they shoot it where in your hip, or where do you get it shot? Where do you get the shot?
I get it in my buttocks. Because you can get it in your shoulder, but then you can't lift your arms. Because I work in a job where it's manual labor, and I have to constantly lift heavy things, and I can't move my arms after. I have to get it in my buttocks, and it's not too bad there. But I mean, either way, it's invasive. I don't agree with. Oh, and Lauren, can I just say one thing quick? I know the show's going to end in about a couple minutes.
Yes,
can I just
please
say one thing really quick? I wanted to comment on something you were saying about before, how psychiatrists will say that if you're aspiring to better yourself or go to college or whatever, you shouldn't be doing that because you're a mental patient. And I know you said something about you going back to school and getting your master's and a PhD. Well, with me, I was told that I wanted to go back to school to finish my degree, and I was basically told that I was delusional and it was a symptom of my psychosis. But with that said, I'm going back to school in the fall, and I'm going to finish my bachelor's degree, and I plan on getting a master's degree. So
good for you.
I don't know where they were. Hey. I don't know where they were trying to prove by telling me I was psychotic, but it's actually going to happen. I'm already registered for classes. I have the bill paid and everything, so I'm all set with that.
Congratulations. That is wonderful news, and I think that this just adds evidence that we can do if we apply, and that we should not listen to the limitations that are put on us so that we remain slaves to these people. And we are going to wrap up the show at this point. There's a lot of events coming up, the Steel Days, the Mind Freedom Conference. I'll put information out. If you'd like to get in touch with me offline, it's area code 718-273-8708. Jason, Anthony, Yvonne, thank you so much for calling in tonight and everybody else. But please call me offline, 718-273-8708. If you have an idea for a show, would like support, or have a news tip that you would like to report anonymously. I think it's important that we all keep talking. Until next time, talk to you soon.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Good night.